Oh, was there a problem with it? I can't remember.
No, I just never got it. I was wondering. Obviously, you didn't need it, or you tell me you needed it.
Right. Okay, David.
Shall I begin?
Please.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for inviting me. And it's a bit of an overwhelming experience because I've never knowingly talked about complexity to anybody when I know there's someone in the audience who is a world authority on the subject. And don't hang back about disagreeing. I'm going to say what I reckon it's all about. And it's extremely unlikely that I will get away without being shown to be wrong in many different ways at the end of the talk. So brace yourselves for everything I've told you to prove to be wrong. The second thing, a bit overwhelming, is that I have 30 minutes, and tradable energy to voters takes at least 50 minutes to explain. Complexity takes another 50 minutes. So I'm going to have to compress it. It will be so brief that there may be occasions on which we haven't the slightest idea of what I'm talking about. So I think the best thing to do, rather than just sit there in confusion and ignorance, is to ask me, just run it past you one more time, so that you know, at least you know what I'm saying, whether it's right or wrong. Okay, right, well the subject, as you see, is the complexity, and making the link between the complexity in a sort of theoretical idea and tradable energy quotas, which is absolutely practical. What I'm going to do is outline in 30 minutes what complexity is and what tradable energy quotas are and how they link up. And I'm going to do this in a very direct way. I'm going to talk about complexity and systems, and I'm going to distinguish between three different types of complexity. One is the complex system. The second is the modular system. And the third is the complicated system. And I'm going to explain the difference between those three and distinguish between them against three criteria. And the three criteria or defining properties are, first, diversity. And in terms of diversity, what I mean is the difference between the parts of a system, so that you can imagine that all of you in your bodies have numerous parts, all of which, both in form and function, do radically different things. Now, there's a great deal more to say about diversity than that, but that's essentially what I mean by diversity. It's the difference in form or function of the component parts of the system. Now, the second thing, criterion I'm going to use is connectedness. That is to say, the extent to which the parts of a system join up. And by joining up, I don't only mean connected, I mean that the extent to which they influence each other, or indeed under some certain circumstances, control each other, or to take the other end of the spectrum, inspire each other. So connectedness is the second key criterion. And the third key criterion is resilience. And I will explain what resilience is as we go along, because I would argue that it's a more complex idea than it's sometimes taken for. So there we are. Now we're going to go down those three criteria. And in the context of complex systems, at the end of this, that will be an approximate indication of what a complex system is. In the case of a complex system, there is strong diversity. I would say it is task diversity. That is to say, the parts are doing fundamentally different functions. I think there's no better example than the human body, or I shall come, I'll say quite a lot about antelopes in a minute. The antelope body consists of an astonishing array of different parts, different shapes, different forms, different functions, different responses to different circumstances. And that is deep diversity. In the case of connectedness, there are taut links and interdependence. That is to say, no part in a complex system has very much freedom about what to do. What the complex system as a whole can do is dramatic. It can be very creative, it can produce results that have not been produced before. But every individual must participate in that. If one's kidneys suddenly decided to do it their own way, just because it was Sunday afternoon and they just felt like doing it, then your kidneys would be in trouble with everything else. Within a complex system, there is very little freedom of function. However, there is an important point, I hope it's not too subtle a point. The kidneys are completely unrestrained in what they do within the body. They don't have to observe anybody else's instruction. They actually do what is best from their point of view. In the context of the body. And Arthur Koestler uses the idea of holons, which is the part of a system being part of a system and also part of the whole. It faces both ways. His image for this is the Roman god Janus, that faced both ways. Okay, and the last thing is resilience. Now this is crucial. I'm saying preventive resilience here. The complex system is an amazing organism, and complex systems may well not exist, for all we know, anywhere in the universe. They have taken a very, very long time to evolve. And they are able, as I said, to produce original and creative results, to do things which haven't been done before. They are able to keep themselves out of trouble by using their wits or by using their bodies. Antelopes can run very fast away from life, and in most times, throughout their entire lives, except until the very last moment, they succeed in escaping life. So preventive resilience is the form of resilience which is observed, which is possessed by a complex system which keeps itself out of trouble. It doesn't hit trouble, but it does. There are lots of grey areas in here, but I'm just describing sort of the polar structures here at the moment. Essentially, the resilience of a complex system is preventive resilience, which keeps it out of trouble. Now, this is a complete contrast with the modular system, which is quite different. Modular system, the diversity in modular system is weak, and it's a textual diversity. The instance of this, I told you I would mention antelopes, so I can make the distinction between one antelope, which, as we've agreed, is a complex system, and a herd of antelopes, which is a modular system, because a herd of antelopes consists of parts which are very similar to each other. And there is diversity between them. Only the strongest and sexiest men manage to have any interaction with the women. But essentially, look, one antelope here from a distance looks more or less the same as any other antelope. That is by no means underrating the diversity, but it's a texture diversity rather than a task and function diversity. I should go back. The texture diversity is particularly evident in the case of, say, a group of communities. The communities are different because they're living in different localities, and they're responding to the same conditions in different ways. So there's diversity in many different dimensions there, but they are essentially independent and part of a modular system. In the case of connectedness, the links are slack, there is independence. That is to say, one antelope or one village in a group of transition villages, a group of communities, they are in touch with each other. Of course they're in touch with each other, they influence each other, they respond to each other, they play with each other, they learn from each other, they inspire each other. There are many points of contact and connectedness, but there's not control. That is, one antelope can decide to do it its own way, and that's fine. If it's successful, then it will succeed. If it's not successful, then it won't succeed. And if it doesn't succeed, then it won't do it again. That is really what this does, of course, is set up a condition for evolution. It's the survival of the fittest. So there is independence, not complete independence, but substantial independence, and there are slack links. And thirdly, there is recovery elastic resilience, which is a completely different form of resilience from the preventive resilience. That is to say, when modular systems are very bad at preventing damage, because they just sit there, very likely, in fact, it's absolutely certain that at least one antelope will be destroyed every day. Very likely that some transition villages will fail. So parts of a transition of a modular system will be destroyed. But a modular system is extremely good at coping when those things happen. It doesn't matter if one antelope goes. So there are many different forms of recovery elastic resilience, and one form is sacrifice and succession. Let's say one dies, but nonetheless is replaced by another, and the whole goes on. There's various forms of adaptation. There are various other ways in which you can cope. So the recovery of elastic resilience is resilience, which in fact is closer to what we normally believe to be resilient. That is to say, we have suffered damage, but nonetheless, it doesn't do us in. Now, then thirdly, we come to a complicated system, and you may wonder how on earth I can make a difference between a complicated system and a complex system. Well, can you apply the same three criteria in the case of diversity? There is a strong functional diversity, but weak form diversity. Now, clearly, I need to explain what this is about, and I need to do so by giving you some sort of intuitive idea about what a complex system might be, and that may be the best way to do that is to give you an illustration from a reasonably practical example, particularly bearing in mind what Sean's just told us. If you could imagine, and I hope that you may think this is a little bit wacky, but actually it's not as wacky as it sounds. If you can imagine a group of villagers, and they're all chuntering along, they're producing their herds of sheep, and they're growing their vegetables, and they've got their choirs, and they've got their churches, then that's absolutely fine. They go along like that for a long time. And then the mood begins to change, and one village begins to think, well, it would really be a good idea if we joined together. That means we'd be able to have better control over the water, we'd be able to have an army, we could go and make war against the neighbours, we could defend ourselves when the neighbours come and make war against us, we could build a big and swanky cathedral, we could build a university, we could have a complexity department. The whole lot of things we can do as a town, which we can't do as a village. So the thing is, ambition takes over, and they fall. And this, of course, happened many, many times. And my favourite example of that is the town of L'Aquila in Tuscany, which, as I'm sure you know, was once 800 years ago was a group of 99 villages, and they did exactly that. 99 villages got together and into a single town. And one of the fountains had 99 spouts for recollecting that time. So it's not entirely theoretical. So but in that process, it meant that villages no longer did their thing. They no longer did their villages doing their roughly similar sort of thing, each producing their own sheep, each producing their own food. They began to specialise. There was a sheep producer, there was a food producer, there was a builder, the builder, the architect, there were the water managers, there was the army. So the thing is that the villages began to lose their complexity, that is to say, their range of activities and a degree of specialisation began. So I would describe that as complexity, and I don't know if it's in the literature or not, I just haven't found it. There. But anyway, from the point of view of diversity, there's a strong functional diversity, but a weak form diversity. Because even the plant-growing villages, and the sheep-growing villages, the army-growing villages, they look much the same. They're the same sort of people, they speak the same language, they're roughly the same. So their form is more or less unchanged, but the task is radically different. Then, in the case of connectedness, well, the thing is that indeed there is very, very powerful connectedness. It's taught, that is to say, one part does influence another, but it's bounded. And by bounded, I mean there is an overarching framework. They say, okay, you can respond as you feel like, but that's only okay so long as you respond within the context of the wider good. So it's a little bit like your kidneys. And I hope this, you think this is an absurd example. You're going to say, yes, but normally I need to produce some more, or let's say, produce more glycogen at this point. But then there's some overarching authority say, no, sunshine, you don't do that. You've got to do it this way. The wider conditions are such. This is the direction we want to go. So the thing is that in the case of connectedness, complicated system, there's a substantial loss of freedom. There's taught connectedness, but the thing is there are other criteria. You can't just use your own intelligence or your own body to make decisions. You actually have to work to the wider in the wider group, whether you want to do so or not. And then the resilience, and that's here again the different form of resilience, which is neither it's got aspect to the preventive resilience, it's got aspect to the recovery elastic resilience. But there's intensification. This is the key intensification, absolutely key idea here. That is to say, if a problem comes, say, to the aquilins, and it's a complicated system, they don't just sort of say, well, okay, we run away, we shrug it off because we're a complex system. They actually have to do something else. They have to build dams. They have to build a larger army. They have to develop. They have to develop their embassies. They have to intensify. They have to put. They face a problem that since there are so many people there because the population is rising so much, fertility is rising and is falling, and therefore they have to put more people into growing their food than they did in the past. Or they may find that they're running out of water, therefore they have to develop very, very complex, very complex irrigation systems. Now, that it means that every individual in the system actually becomes much more efficient. They become much better at doing what they did before. Carpenters become more efficient carpenters. Irrigation experts become more effective irrigation experts. But, and this is the key point, for the system as a whole, more work has to be done in order to keep the whole system going. This is the vital thing. So we tend to think that as a political economy advances from, say, an early stage, or ultimately a hunter-gatherer stage, into a more advanced civilization, it becomes more efficient. Actually, it becomes less efficient. It means it is committed to doing more and more just to keep going. And of course, we're absolutely finding this at the moment. Not only are we still in the process of intensification, but we're just getting to the kind of the high peak of intensification, which was only able just to keep money, to keep oil and gas coming along, to run our cars, keep our homes warm. If we actually take part in the most completely staggering things at the very edge of any sort of any technology, such as drilling for oil, we're 3 miles below the sea. In the Gulf of Mexico. At the moment, where technologists say, don't worry, sunshine, leave it to us, we know what we're doing. But actually, we're developing technologies which are almost impossible. And indeed, when they break down, they are impossible, they're almost impossible to repair, as you've discovered. So we're in the state of extreme intensification, but to back off from that extreme case, I think it's worth bearing in mind that the complicated system, that is to say, the civilization that we belong to, is a highly complicated system, is only able to exist because it is so inefficient. It depends on a vast quantity of intermediate goods. And the good news, I've just been telling you bad news up to now, but the good news is that the solution, I would argue, to the future is to recognize that if we de-intensify, then there is a possibility of actually finding ways of getting a far, far smaller quantity of resources to work for us much more efficiently. So it's actually a matter of going back. Now, the thing is, I've outlined three kinds of relationship, three kinds of system. And I'd just like to quickly to point out, very, very briefly, three aspects of this, just to chew over the idea a little bit more. One is that a complex system needs the setting of a modular system. And I think of an example of that. I think young Sean over there. I mean, clearly, he's a complex system, I'm sure I would agree with that. Yeah, but Sean is only able to develop, to apply his complexity, live as a complex system, so long as he lives in a system in which there's a certain amount of modularity and maturity. He's not absolutely required every single day to do exactly what he's required to do because he works for a bank. Now, I forecast that Sean is not going to work for a bank. And that's because it's highly complex, and maybe more complex than most other systems. But yeah, that is the essential thing. That only at any point of being a complex system, if you're working within a modular system, or it's a modular system with its slack connectedness, which makes it possible to actually apply the complexity that you have. The second point is inverse of that. A modular system needs the membership of complex systems. Cannot be a modular system worthy of the name that actually does anything, you know, local bit, unless you actually consist of complex systems. So there's clearly an interaction between modularity and mutual dependency. And the third thing is a complicated. I think I've broken the connection. Okay. I'm really sorry about that. Can you wind me up again? I'm so sorry. Right, I've switched on again. No?
Thanks, Dave. Very interesting.
Right. And the third point, which you didn't time to develop, but I think is a too obvious relation to that, is that a complicated system will break down unless it de-intensifies. Which is really what, in some ways, summarising what I've been saying at the moment. Our system, complicated system, since we've got the future is to break down unless it goes into de-intensification. De-intensification, what it requires, simplification between the modules, the modules. That is to say, the change of a relationship between the model from a taut controlling relationship to a much slacker relationship, which gives the modules freedom. And it means complexity within its modules. I think I'm summarising what I've just said. The modules themselves need to become more complex. So the thing is, in the transition world, one really is talking about a village of a transition town or a transition village developing a level of complexity which doesn't have before. Simplification within a community is a process of complexification. And complexification isn't my word, it comes from Kirkpatrick Sale, who wrote that wonderful book on scale, which is probably one of the best books in this field. But he said, what we need to do is to complexify. And if we do that, we end up with an efficiency gain, because as we get rid of the complication, we get rid of the infrastructures, and the intermediate economy, which is the possibilities open up. Now, I've taken too long on that, so I'm going to have to go through the tradable energy quotas application of this even faster than that. Are you up with me so far?
Yes, this is great.
Yeah, that's true, Andrea, where'd you go? And it will be a dash. Now, the thing is that if you don't understand this, then maybe the best thing to do is either buy the book, or to look at the website, or to wait for there's a super book to come out in 3 months' time. Or all of the above.
The super book is a report with the all-party parliamentary group on peak oil on tradable energy. Right?
So, yeah. Or come to the pub afterwards. lots of opportunities open up. Okay, the context is climate change and peak oil, about which I need to say nothing at all. So what would we need under these circumstances? First, we'd need a guarantee that intended reductions in energy will be met. Is that clear? Good. Secondly, we need an energy numerator. Is that clear?
No.
Oh, I'm surprised. Oh, good. Thanks. Someone said that.
Yes.
What this means is that the it needs to be measured in terms of energy, not in terms of money or in terms of carbon emissions or anything like that. Because if we measure it in terms of money, then the whole thing becomes a contest for people who are getting the most money. If it's measured in terms of carbon emissions, it becomes very, very complicated, very difficult to work out what your carbon emissions are. It needs to be measured in terms of a very, very simple thing, which we're used to doing, that's kilowatt hours when we buy our energy, liters or gallons when we buy our petrol. So the thing is, all quantities are mapped onto energy. And I've come back to this many, many times. If that's unsatisfactory, it'll become more satisfactory as we go on. And the third thing it needs is absolutely crucial, which is almost always left out of the discussion. It needs entitlements to energy. You could use the word rations of energy. The problem about rations is that people tend to think that rations are something involving a big brother, say, no, you can't use any more than that. That's your lot of sunshine, go home. What rations are actually is completely the opposite. They're saying, we have a situation of scarcity at the moment, and because a rationing system exists, it means that you are guaranteed to get your basically equal fair entitlement. So it provides you with entitlement for energy, or food, or whatever it is that is rationed. Under circumstances of scarcity, people will be on their knees, virtually, whether it be on their knees for a rationing system. The idea of having a situation of scarcity, scarce energy, without a rationing system is horrific, because the other ways of allocating energy would be by the people with the money bidding the price of energy up, or by shooting people in petrol queues, and there's other systems, but none of which are satisfactory, and all of which have been tried. So there needs to be a guarantee of And the fourth thing, it needs a framework for cooperation. The reason for this is that as we know, not only from Sean's talk, but because if we didn't know this, we probably wouldn't be here. We need to recognise how dramatic the change is going to have to be to make any sort of serious progress towards what we've got to achieve. We need to bear in mind David Mackay's book on renewable energy makes the point that there is absolutely, it's a good thing to make a little steps, but do not allow those words, every little help, to pass your lips. What it does is it gives you a feeling that so long as you turn off your mobile phone charger during the day when you're not charging your mobile phone, you're moving in the right direction. Well, you're not moving in the right direction, you're coughing up. So it has to, one really has to be talking about the dramatic changes. In order to get to that dramatic change, that there's no way that we can individually do it on our own. It's got to be done on a community-wide basis. It's got to be done I'm a fast learner, as Professor
Eve, just Eve.
I didn't know which name to call you.
Just
Eve.
Just
for Eve.
Yes.
And Eve has just explained. I'm talking about a multi-layered approach here. And the thing about, we need to be talking about small scale, middle scale, and large scale. And if there is one layer which is arguably more crucial than any other layer, and that's arguable whether it is or not, another is community. It has to be a community-wide system. So towns have to work together, neighbourhoods have to work together. So it has to be a system which invites and requires community interaction. Okay, well, I'm now going to briefly take you through what tradable energy quotas are, in case anybody else doesn't know. I'm sure people tend not to know, even though they protest they do. Tradable energy quotas are an electronic system for rationing either carbon-rated energy or individual scarce fuels, or both, for all energy users at a national level. Various things to point out, it's at a national level, it's not at a local level, it's not an international level, it's designed for an international level. It's designed, it says carbon-rated energy or individual scarce fuel, it's designed in the context of peak oil and or climate change. It's equally applicable to both, absolutely equally applicable. Okay, there they are. And this is how they work, and I'll dash through this at very high speed. All individuals receive an entitlement to tax units. If that's clear. My indicator in the pale blue cardigan is one. Is that clear?
Good.
Right. All other users obtain their units through the weekly tender. So it applies to every energy user, and that the Department of the Environment, the Queen, the Lord Chief Justice, courts, everybody, everybody is involved in the scheme. There is a rolling annual budget. That is to say, on the first day, 1 year's entitlement is issued. At the end of the first week, it's topped up with one new week's entitlement. So that there is always one annual budget in one annual supply of techs in circulation, and the budget goes down year by year. And units are surrendered when energy is purchased. That's pretty obvious. And there are individuals who use less than their entitlement may sell them. And you know what's coming next? Individuals who want more may buy them. And some people find difficulty with that, but they think, oh, well, if they can buy more, then of course there's no cap, is it? But of course they can only buy more within the context of the budget. So there's a guarantee that as the budget goes down, if there's a...
You want a pen?
Yeah.
There we go.
Well, thank you. So really the budget, this picture of the budget, the budget goes down like this. That determines, right down 20 years ago, and that determines the quantity of text that units are available. So whatever happens, one can't exceed the budget, because if it's not in the text units are issued only up to the point which is set by the budget, and you can't buy energy unless you have text units any more than you can buy energy unless you have money. And one implication of this is means that, you know, since there's a guarantee, you don't need a whole caravanserai of other measures coming along saying, well, you've got to do this and you've got to do that. Because if, as long as text exists, that's one of the criteria of a good system design, I would argue, is that it simplifies things enormously. You just do one thing, you get leverage, just pull, like the cat's cradle, once at school, you pull one string and your fingers come together. So text is the scheme which does not need a backup. Something like 215 or 150. A very, very large number of government schemes, all of which you have to learn. They take up a huge amount of paper, a lot of learning, and they can all be put on the bond fund. Right, and text rating system. And this is a fairly tedious slide, but I'll just go through it quickly. But it needs to be said, because most people don't understand. Because of the energy numeraire, it means that you're not buying kilowatt hour. You're not buying carbon emissions. What you're buying is energy. That is, your entitlement is set in terms of energy units. You know how much energy you can buy. Because every form of energy has a different carbon rating. So that when you buy a litre of petrol, that has a certain carbon rating, so you know how many text units you have to surrender. So it becomes incredibly simple. You just go into a petrol station and buy text units and you surrender. You buy petrol and you surrender money in the normal way, i.e. you pay them. At the same time, you also pay with text units. You don't even have to be aware of doing this, because you surrender when you buy a petrol at a petrol station, many of you still do, then you just give a card and the money is taken off the card. Your text number is on there, your money, your text units are subtracted from your text card, so you're not even aware of doing so. If you don't have a card, you'll probably only have to buy energies on like four or maybe eight times a year, and nearly all of you, I would imagine, use direct debit, and you're not really aware, certainly I'm never aware of actually paying an electricity or gas bill. Exactly the same way, text would be involved in a direct debit system and be taken off at the same time, in the same way. So this, I hope I haven't labored that. It means that you really don't have to spend any time calculating, doing any sort of carbon calculation or anything like that. You don't have to fiddle around with cards. You don't have to keep any records. You just get a bank statement at the end of every year. It's a hands-free thing. And if it's not hands-free, then it means that people's minds are taken off. What really matters is getting their carbon emissions down or transforming their use of energy. But so in principle, so a carbon unit is one unit of carbon, one unit is 1 kilogram of carbon dioxide. Or in the case of fuel units, one unit is 1 liter of oil or a cubic meter of gas or a kilowatt hour of electricity. So that mapping is done automatically, so you just don't have to mess around. Anything else wouldn't work. So there we are. That's the budget. And I was just going to say, well, let's just take that as read. Lunch, and I've talked to Eve about this, and she said, well, no, actually, let's take it apart. So fortunately, I have got some slides, we do take it apart. And that's fairly incomprehensible at first glance. So I'm just going to dash around the budget, if that's okay. It begins at the beginning with, there we are, the Energy Policy Committee, which is now called the Climate Change Committee, but I've left it the Energy Policy Committee for no good reason. But it was basically, it only there really because it was designed on the Monetary Policy Committee, which was the one good thing.
Hold on, I think you've lost your...
Off again.
Yeah.
The hard man's tied out.
Yes. Oh, it's okay. That's it.
Yes. Okay.
But so it's equivalent to the Monetary Policy Committee, which is an independent committee over which the government doesn't have any control. And the Monetary Policy Committee, as you know, sets interest rates, and the Energy Policy Committee was designed for that. And even though the committee's probably changed its name now. Has changed the name now. Nonetheless, essentially, it's taken out of politics, but it's not a government decision anymore. The interest rates are a government decision. Now, the Energy Policy Committee sets the budget, which I've just drawn, and that information goes to a Quotico. I think we needn't call it Quotico any longer. It's a little bit childish, isn't it? It's been around for a long time. It basically is the registrar. This is a completely unoriginal scheme. Every single aspect of tech has been stolen from something that already exists, a unit trust industry or something. I have no creative imagination whatsoever. And that is based on the unit trust registrar system, which keeps the account very much like a bank account, actually. And that registrar issues the quota, and it's in two parts. One is the 40% entitlement, the other is a 60% tender. And that 40% just represents the proportion of energy which is used by individuals at the moment. 60% is used by everybody else. And in the case of the tender is part of a market, and all units are traded in the market. So if you want to sell units or buy them, you sell them in the market. And that means as a large market, it means it would be fairly free of volatility and pretty well impossible for any individual or any cartel to control. One good thing is that some money comes out of the market, and the money can go to the government, and the government can use the money to enable us to achieve this, or assist us to achieve this dramatic transformation. Units flow through the energy cycle, and they we go to energy when you buy fuel or electricity from a supplier, they have to get units are surrendered to them. And then the units go up through the fuel wholesalers, through the fuel extractors, to the basic producers, and then it's surrendered. So the whole thing is a circular system, and it's self-monitoring. What you don't need is a lot of chaps in white, men and women in white coats and clipboards making sure it is actually done. There's no enforcement that's required. Unfortunately, the Zero Carbon Britain report has improved, or I think they imagine improved on this diagram. In a way which is a combination between being incomprehensible and irritating. And there is one big chunk which says enforcement, and I think it seems that all people have to do is just take one look at this diagram. It's an enormous letters, enforcement, and they say we don't want anything.
Can I ask a question? Organisations, whether they are schools, hospitals, private companies and so on, I take it have no entitlement and have to buy their energy quota, is that correct?
Yes, it is. That
seems a little.
This comes up, and very often from nurses who say that there's absolutely no way our hospital is
struggling
at the moment. But there's a couple of things to say about this. And thing number one is we don't know how we tend to assume that when people have to buy tax units, they have to shell out a lot of money. We have no idea what the price of the tax units is going to be. It's not about a price-based system. One of the aims of the scheme is to keep the price down as much as possible. And people have had great difficulty in understanding that and say, well, of course, if the price isn't high, it's not going to work. The European Union emissions trading scheme is a price-based system. Unless the price is high, then it provides no incentives. In the case of tax, it's not like that. As you know, when everyone has a complex system with a number of variables, the number of variables you can actually control, it always is one less than the number of variables, because there always has to be one degree of freedom. In the case of tax, there are two variables. One is quantity, and the other is price. We're controlling quantity, and therefore, if we control the quantity, one has to allow the price to be flexible. So the price may be very low, so it may not be, well, I'll come to you in a minute, it may not be a problem. And it's a big, big, really, there should be a really big incentive to keep the price low. The second point is that climate change and peak oil have no sense of justice at all. We all have to dramatically reduce our demand for energy. And among the organisations that have enormous potential for reducing their demand for energy, as I know by personal experience of a school, for example, on the Oswald Street, is schools. One school near Oswald Street decided to do this, and they're almost carbon free at the moment. The other said, no, we're a school, we don't have to do this. And they have enormous energy bills. So the thing is that we are really all involved in this. People who live very, very carbon intensive lifestyles, because you know they've inherited an old drafty rectory, and they're not feeling very, you know, they're not able to go. Nonetheless, they really have got problems under these circumstances. But the good news is that since they have got problems, and since it's a community based scheme, since it's so public, everybody knows what everybody else's circumstances is in. We're all motivated to help each other to reduce our carbon emissions. A person in that situation will signal the need for help. It will be a community task to help him or her to reduce carbon emissions. So the thing is a tremendous incentive for all of us to assist all of us to reduce our carbon emissions.
The price floats or the price is set?
So
I can set the price at which I sell my quotas.
You're a price taker. The market. You know what the price is in the market.
There's one price for everyone, but it varies depending on the demand and supply.
It's the market price.
Okay, hang on. So the market, I didn't understand that. So there's a market which regulates the price?
It doesn't regulate the price any more than the market for...
Okay, so it's a straight free market commodity that I can trade.
Well, yeah, that's right.
That's what I wanted to check. So I have individual level control of pricing.
No individual, no buyer or seller can control the price, no.
Okay, good.
Okay, we can storm on with this. Right, okay, well, I'm now going to go very, very quickly through 12 conditions. We just need to see some sort of depth about what we're doing. First of all, tech provides a guarantee, which is pretty fundamental. The second thing, it provides time to plan ahead. As you see, the budget is set for 20 years. If we're really going to do any of these dramatic things we have to do, there's no way we can achieve them within sort of a couple of weeks or a couple of years. And we tend to think short term. We absolutely do things short term. What techs do is they bring the long term into public choice and into our individual choices. Because when we talk about the Energy Descent Action Plan, as Sean has explained, when we talk about tech, we talk about energy, we're not really just talking about energy at all. And we only have to think about it for 5 minutes. You realize that if we're going to really reduce the demand for energy, then we've got to change the way we grow food, change the way we work, change our use of transport, change our houses, change how we dress, change our skills. There's no aspect of life which isn't going to be changed dramatically. And if one's going to go beyond it, and suddenly actually, as soon as a penny drops about it, we're really going to completely transform the way the structure of our towns, our land use, and everything, then that's a 20-year job. Well, it's a 30-year job, but at least a 20-year job. And so what techs do, and this is absolutely fundamental, which you can't do in any other way, except for the quantitative-based scheme, it sets a time horizon over 20 years. So it again provides time to plan ahead, without which we're in deep trouble. It leaves money with the user. It doesn't take money away from the user, because if the recession carries on, the last thing we want is any sort of fine system or any sort of tax system. It has a basic equity, is that everybody gets the same entitlement. There's an assured ration, which we discussed, everybody is guaranteed a ration to energy. It's specified in terms of energy, so it's not actually, if it's specified in terms of money, people will be constantly thinking about how to cheat the system or lobbying for a change of the price or something like that, but it's specified in terms of energy. So energy comes within people's own control, requiring people to take their own action. It's both for fuel scarcity and climate. There's a sense of ownership of the scheme, because the price, for lots and lots of reasons, It requires individuals to make their own solution. There's the real sense of lean thinking about this. Yes? I'm really glad you asked that, because this is not at all the case, no. Since individuals are involved, and all other energy users, all companies are involved, in the same market, at the same time, under the circumstances, under the same budget. So this is cooperation, this is the fundamental thing. Not only, when we're talking about cooperation here, not only cooperating with neighbours, it's cooperating with companies, it's cooperating with everybody. So the thing is, and it's only used for energy, not used when you buy airline tickets, not used when you buy grain, not used when you buy anything. But airline tickets are included, of course, because when airlines buy their energy, they have to surrender units in exactly the same way. So it's based on the nation's entire energy demand. And so the thing is that it also includes the imported energy. Don't let's go into come to imports just yet. We'll discuss that afterwards. But you're leaving that aside. It includes the imported energy of every plastic bottle. So it includes everything we do, because everything we do is based on energy. So in fact, even though it just seems to be just about energy, actually is about everything we do as well. But that's clear. Okay. So ownership, we're all involved, because the price of units depends on the demand on the demand for units. The demand for units depends on how effective we are at getting down that energy descent, that budget. And therefore, the price is under control of you, sir, and you. We are all individually and collectively in control of our prices. Our scheme, set by our Energy Policy Committee for our nation, and the price is down to us. So there's ownership. Maybe it's not their ownership, it's not going to work. The government is there to help. The government is in the same boat. They're having to cope with the problem, having to get by with much less use of energy. They're not just they're there to tell you what to do, because you're there. We're all within the same scheme. It's a completely different role for government. We need to recognise that. There's competitive advantage. I mentioned that. This is constantly coming up. If it were the first mover, one nation that took the initiative, then it would have the advantage of being more energy efficient. It would have the advantage of knowing how the scheme worked. It would have the advantage of being able to, of developing energy efficient technologies which would sell all over the world. And it would have moral leadership. And it would also have the advantages of maintaining stability and social order under conditions of certainty. Well, there are tremendous advantages, therefore, overwhelming advantages for individual nations to take the lead in this rather than waiting for the others to do so. And there's a pool, which is a long concept, but I don't think I've got time to go into it. A basic principle of lean thinking, which is they don't tell people what to do, but set things up in such a way that they can work out what to do for themselves. Actually, start using the biggest energy resource we've got available to us, which is the space between the top of our nose and the top of our head, our brain space. On the whole, people's brains have been switched off. We need to switch them on again, and that's what techs are designed to do. And finally, it activates a common purpose, which is the convergence between individual motivation and collective motivation. The common purpose is a shared aim to reach a shared goal, where collective aims are advanced by the individual purpose, and individual aims are advanced by the collective purpose. So the convergence of motivation. That's what happens in tax, that you can't read it. That's an example. That's what happens in tax. There's no guarantee. There's no time to plan ahead. It takes money from the user. It's regressive. There's no assured ration. It's specified in terms of money. It's wholly unsuited for fuel scarcity. There's no ownership. The government is there to punish with competitive disadvantage. There's push and there's no common purpose. Not from tax, and that tax is a good idea. So, okay, we're just coming to the end now. So what do we need? This is the slide you've already seen. Just to check we've done that. The guarantee that intended reductions will be met. Yes, tick on that. The energy enumerator, yes, we've got that. There's entitlements to energy, there's a framework for cooperation. Right, okay, so we've done that job. Now, how do we link this up with complexity? Well, That's a slide that that's the last slide on complexity. And I just remind you what I said. De-intensification requires, seemed like a long time ago, de-intensification requires simplification between its modules, complexity between within its modules. Okay. This is what the only way in which we can actually achieve anything like the energy demand, reduction in energy demand we need, is by decomplicatifying our society. That is to say, getting rid of a vast quantity of transport, developing self-sufficiently, building the complexity within the module. So we need to do both those. Simplifying between modules, i.e. without building our own communities, and as you use Kirkpatrick Sale's word again, complexifying our communities. So, and by achieving that, getting rid of that huge burden which has destroyed every previous civilization that has failed, that huge encrustation of intensification, that big intermediate structure which is impossible for us to sustain. Result of that, we do get the efficiency gain. And I would argue that we get an efficiency transformation. We're looking not just at an improvement in efficiency, we're talking about a revolution here. And I really don't believe there's any other way of achieving that revolution, but I think it actually could just happen. And I think what could make it happen is the peak oil. When energy gets scarce, it'll suddenly dawn on people, maybe some of the people in the right places, that if we approach peak oil without an energy rationing system in place, then we're going to be in deep trouble. And so we end up with a system scale rule. Large-scale tasks, this is familiar to you now, large-scale tasks do not need large-scale solutions. They need small-scale solutions within a large-scale framework. Should explain that. that's the rating system. Every form of energy is rated depending on its global warming potential. Do you remember that slide I showed you long way back? GWP stands for global warming potential. This is the one. One unit equals 1 kilogram of carbon dioxide in terms of global warming potential. That is to say, so if one has a fuel which has in effect very, very low, or even zero carbon dioxide, then its rating is correspondingly lower. Mm-hmm. So it's absolutely takes that into account. And of course, it would be a tremendous incentive to use renewables. I mean, because if there are renewables which has a zero carbon emissions, then you don't have to surrender the tax at all. Then you can sell the tax, so you get immediate financial incentive. Off to you.
Very, very simple point of clarification. So I go to the gas station, I take out my credit card, I buy some gasoline, I spend so many pounds and so many tacks, and there's some kind of accounting system which stores my tack balance. Is that it?
And followed the last sentence. Some kind of accounting system which
stores my tack balance. Personal.
Yes.
Okay, so basically it's a parallel accounting system for energy expenditure.
It's very, very like a bank account.
Yeah, very simple. So we end up with two currencies that flow
against
each other.
In fact, it almost exactly is a bank account.
Yeah,
because yes.
Got it. Perfect. Thank God. I just wanted to double check that it was exactly what it was. Yes.
Does actually use a great deal of energy. If one follows through, as that wonderful book, that wonderful film, A Farm for the Future, did. If you haven't seen it, then do see it, A Farm for the Future. The sandwich, the energy rating of a sandwich, global warming potential of the carbon emissions produced by making a sandwich, is substantial. But you don't actually have to surrender tech to buy a sandwich. All the people, the sandwich makers, had to surrender tech to buy the packaging and provide the fertilizer and to make the bread. So it's completely covered, but not by your tech, but by
the more energy intensive sandwich, the maker would have to buy more energy to make it, so they'd have to put the price up. So you would just find it was more expensive in money.
Okay, Hammond, so there's no consumer trading of this stuff. It's not a consumer traded currency. It floats
But you can buy and sell them. You can buy and sell them, but you will buy and sell them on the market. So I'm not,
but it's not a point of sale transaction.
Only for energy. Only for energy and gas.
For primary energy, it's point of sale. Everywhere else, it's factored into the price.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it.
Exactly the idea of having surrendering techs for buying primary energy sources, but not for sandwiches, which seems quite odd to me. And this idea of having this essentially parallel economy in techs, why not simply set a quota for all of the carbon producing sources that are imported or extracted by industry, and then
an extraction
and import quota.
Yeah,
and then let the money markets control, how much.
But that would just raise the price of energy and people who
can
afford.
Perhaps, yeah, but this that isn't.
But no, that's exactly what we want to avoid, because it would just mean that energy would become very scarce, and people who could afford to buy expensive energy could buy it, and people who couldn't afford to buy it wouldn't buy it, and it would just become a money-based thing, and just one more way of damning the poor.
But to me, that's a separate issue. There is issues about equality in our economy, but it strikes me as overly complicated. Or perhaps you could say that a quota simply based on imports and extraction is the simplest thing that could possibly work, and that's kind of the direction.
This is the basic principle we've been talking about in terms of complexity, which is involving people at the right level. And the right level includes individuals, includes families, includes neighbourhoods, includes communities. If we just hit in individual, we just have one thing which just affects one level, that is to say, the energy importers have to pay, have a quota and have to and therefore raise their price, then all that will do is raise the price, and it will just be, the energy will be either unavailable or incredibly expensive, or both, for everybody except people who are lucky enough to be able to afford it. And of course it'll go deeply, from the point of view of the energy consumer, the only aspect of this which will be tangible to them will be, for goodness sake, the price today is incredibly high, I can't afford it, sod the government. What we actually have to do is do a whole range of things, which I'm sorry I haven't explained well enough, a whole range of things such as give the sense of ownership and get people think in terms of money, of energy rather than money, and give the sort of sense of the long-term time horizon, give the sense that it's not just those dreadful energy providers that are causing the problem, that it's a collective problem. All these things which I've developed, all these things come out of text which do not come out of your alternative scene, which is just giving a quota to the energy.
Well, then I've got two questions.
I mean, I was going to agree with what you said. Simply, instead of VAT, you have EAT, energy additive tax or something, and then the government will sort of that in one stroke. But okay, you have some answers for it. But what I want to ask really is that has this been experimented, maybe to show that within transition towns, within the community where people know each other, would it work at that level?
Well, there's a thing called CRAGS, which is Carbon Reduction Action Groups, which Anna has been involved with for a long time. And that's kind of that idea, it's groups getting together to sort of do this on a voluntary scale. The obvious problem with that, as Maya would doubtless point out, is that it's not something that you can sort of gradually scale up, obviously, because if it's non-compulsory, then the people who choose to partake are penalised and the people who don't benefit. So in many ways, I see CRAGS myself as more of an awareness raising thing, if you like, an exploration. I think one of the challenges with TECs is that it doesn't lend itself really to pilot projects.
Well,
it's something that you either implement or don't.
If there's anything, it is large scale, it looks.
No.
Nation level, you are.
Really can't.
It's system
scale. Large scale framework with a small scale solution within a large scale framework. It's exactly that. As Sean said, his three little dots. The action happens below the three little dots, and the decisions happen above. You need to bring them together. That's exactly what text does. It enables and requires and empowers people to make the decisions about their energy consumption because there's a large scale framework. So it is a large scale solution, and it's also a small scale solution. That is to say, it's a system literate system. It's a coherent system.
One key component of your idea is the entitlement for every person.
and what factors you need to take into account when setting this entitlement?
As the scheme is designed at present, it is an absolutely equal allocation to every adult individual, and children are not included. Now, the advantages of that are simplicity, lots of advantages, simplicity, complication if people got different entitlements and it would start getting very, very difficult, an enormous amount of politics would occur. And also there's a sort of sanity about it, because here we all are basically individuals on the planet, and we've just got to get this right. And you know that you I'm sure you did chemistry at school, and if you do it, you know about litmus paper. If you do a litmus paper in the acid solution, it goes one color, so alkaline is another color. That's exactly what text do. It shows if there's a problem, it shows if individuals have problems. So if you live in a large house and you drive in your Porsche up to Wolverhampton to work every day, then you will discover, oh, shock, horror, that you have to surrender an awful lot of techs. And you may very well say, well, I've got to drive from London to Wolverhampton every day in my Porsche, and therefore I need more tech units. And your local authority, your MP might say, yes, he does need the tech units. You end up with huge complexity. Much better than an absolutely rock-solid guarantee that everybody gets the same thing. Now, one more thing to say. As we're in LSE, you may have heard of, I hope you've heard of Imre Lakatos, who talked about the distinction between the core and the periphery in a system. When every system has a core, which is the hard, solid core, which is in the system, inside the system. Round the system, there are a lot of peripheral things. Now, the thing is, those peripheral things can change. It's still basically a system. And this is part of the folklore of LSE, as I'm sure you all know. Now, one can, if one wanted, local authorities could change the allocation if they wanted to. They could say, well, okay, since you have to drive to Wolverhampton, we're going to give you an extra £25 a week as a subsidy. So there are things one can do, but basically the answer to your question is that there's an absolute rock-solid equity between everybody.
Okay,
a
couple of things.
So it's the carbon budget, quite legally, the national carbon budget.
Babies and every man, woman, and child.
Yeah. And this is where Kyoto would run.
Yes, not children, I just said, only adults. I've got a clarification here and a question there, but before we do that, I must say that we have run out of time, so I need to ask for your permission to carry on for another 10-15 minutes. If you do need to leave because you have to catch a train or whatever, please feel free to do so. We do have, the room is available for a little bit longer, so with everyone's permission, perhaps we can carry on for a few more minutes. Is that okay, everyone? Great. Okay, clarification and then question.
I was just, if each country, as I'm saying, nation state would set a quota for each individual, would there be, I mean, how would you have equity across countries? Could it follow a sort of contraction and convergence type model where, you know, all nation states are trying to converge on a safe quota?
Yeah, well, the question is, if each country sets their own budget, is there equality there? And how does that link with congressional convergence? Well, the initial budget set by each country would depend entirely on its current energy demand. And they would then set their budget in the light of a realistic expectation or other circumstances down from that level. So that Hungary, let's suppose that Hungary has a sort of fairly low per capita energy demand individually, and let's suppose the United States has a relatively high one, then absolutely no doubt for the first few years, America would start at a higher level of budget measured per capita, but then they would go down. Now the criteria which they would use down which to go down that energy set, there are many criteria. Contraction, convergence could be one. It could be the oil depletion protocol. It could be circumstances of peak oil. It could be the shock of climate change, which put everybody on a high alert, able to achieve a much, much more dramatic reduction than they would have thought possible. There are many, many indications and many criteria which would enter the heads of the Carbon Policy Committee to set.